What I'd like to do now is I'd like to go into the background of what we would call pre-Socratic philosophy. And it's very important to understand pre-Socratic philosophy before we understand Socrates, because for a long period in his life, Socrates was apparently a pre-Socratic. Meaning that when we get to Aristophanes' Clouds, we're going to see a portrait of Socrates as a kind of philosopher that we would recognize as a pre-Socratic philosopher, not as a Socratic philosopher. And the portrait of our understanding of what Socratic philosophy is based primarily on Plato's dialogues and also Xenophon's Socratic writings. Although even in those texts, there are clues about the fact that Socrates at one time was a pre-Socratic. But in the Clouds, what we have is a very clear portrait of Socrates as a pre-Socratic philosopher. So what we need to do is we need to get a sense of what pre-Socratic philosophy means. Hence this little book, The Pre-Socratic's Reader. Now this little book consists of just the fragments, the disjecta membra of philosophy before Socrates. There are no full extant works of philosophy before Plato's dialogues, earlier than Plato's dialogues. All earlier philosophical writings exist only in fragments that were embedded as quotations in the writers of later philosophers. Other fragments were found in various papyrus scrolls, usually from Oxyrhynchus in Egypt. For instance, there's a passage from Antiphon that we're going to look at very closely that was from one of the Oxyrhynchus papyri. They started coming out of the sands in northern Egypt to the west of the Nile in the 1880s. These texts are fascinating because, particularly the ones that I pointed out to you to read, because you're going to find echoes of all of these ideas showing up in the Clouds. So the main reason I wanted you to look at certain selections is because you'll find it all very familiar when you start reading Aristophanes' Clouds. Now, I didn't, however, ask you to read the most important pre-Socratic thinkers. And in my view, those are Heraclitus and Parmenides. I would highly recommend that you do read them because particularly Heraclitus' fragments are really quite wonderful. They're really gnomic and rich and well-crafted. And some of them almost read like they were just crafted as one-line aphorisms. And Parmenides' poem is a quite remarkable piece of philosophy, too. As a background to the pre-Socratics, what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk about what came before the pre-Socratics, pre-pre-Socratic thinking. And that means pre-philosophical thinking. Because in order to really understand what was remarkable and revolutionary about early Greek philosophy, you really have to understand what came before it. And so what I want to talk about are, first of all, what you can call pre-philosophical conceptions of order. Because every culture has some concept that names the order of things. The Chinese have this notion of the Tao. The Indians have the notion of Dharma, the Egyptians Mat, Hebrew word Mishpat, and the Greek words Nomos and Dike, all can be translated as the way. The way being understood as the customary way of things. The way things have always been, the way things will always be. Their characteristic patterns of behavior that they've exhibited from time out of mind. These concepts encompass both natural processes, the sun and the stars and the seasons, and the behavior of animals, as well as human traditions and institutions and practices. And there's no distinction made between the way of natural things and the way of human things in pre-philosophic thought. They're just all understood as pretty much on the same model. It's an interesting concept because it antedates the distinction between nature and convention. This distinction is not made in pre-philosophical thought. This is all subsumed under this notion of the customary, habitual way of things from time immemorial. Now, there's a problem with that, though. And the problem is very simple because the way of animal natures, for instance, is not as variable as the way of human things. The way of non-human nature is quite regular, whereas the way of human nature varies constantly from time to time and from place to place. For instance, if you want to look at the mating habits of, say, armadillos, I don't know anything about their mating habits. They might be rather uninteresting,
okay.
At least to us.
Okay.
But imagine that we're imagine that we're studying the mating habits of armadillos. It wouldn't really matter if we were studying armadillos north or south of the Rio Grande, because armadillos are armadillos, and armadillos and armadillos and armadillo, and it doesn't matter where the armadillo is, it's going to behave exactly the same way. However, if we wanted to study mating and dating habits of human beings, we would discover that there are very different ways of doing that north and south of the Rio Grande. Why is that? Because there are different cultures. There are different nations and different nations with different histories and different cultures. And because of this fact, the way human beings do things varies dramatically from time to time and place to place. If we were to look at the way that human beings date and mate in America today versus the way it happened immediately after World War II, we'd see that there were amazing differences within the same culture, different stages in time. And this enormous variability of human things seems to be, well, important. We need to somehow thematize this and make sense of why this is the case. But in pre-philosophic traditional forms of thought, that distinction isn't made. And the reason why it isn't made is this. Well, there are a number of reasons, I suppose. First of all, most people in traditional societies don't move around very much. And the ones who do and notice things that other people do simply disregard them as having any particular importance or weight. The other people are just barbarians. They're backwards. They're stupid. And our way is the right way. No matter who says that, the presumption in every traditional society is that our way is the right way and the true way, and that the other ways are false and bad. And this assumption that our way is the right way is part and parcel with an attitude that basically identifies what's good with what's ancient. In any traditional society, there's a presumption that the older something is, the better it is. There's a presupposition, therefore, that in some ways our ancestors are better than us, and we have to look up to them as we look back to them. Now, of course, people recognize in any society, no matter how stagnant or static, that there are always going to be bits of progress or transformation, the refinement of human behavior over time. That's just inevitable. And so it seems that in ordinary human things, we're wiser than our ancestors. However, the wisdom of the ancestors, the superior wisdom of the ancestors, is not wisdom in merely human things. If you're going to explain why your ancestors, especially your most remote ancestors, are superior to you and you have to look up to their wisdom, ultimately what you're going to do is something like this. You're going to use the venerable Greek phrase, our ancestors who dwelt nearer to the gods. There's some sense in which our ancestors were closer to the divine, and the wisdom that they have that makes them superior to us is a kind of divine wisdom. And in traditional societies, you're going to find ideas like this, that the founders of a civilization, a city, a culture, are gods, or if they're not gods, then they're the offspring of gods, and if not the offspring of gods, then on particularly intimate terms with gods. So you look at Moses, who is the only man to have seen Yahweh face to face. He's the lawgiver of the Jews. Muhammad had a particularly intimate relationship with Allah, which made him the founder and the lawgiver of Islam, and so on and so forth. Jesus was God, as well as the Son of God, and so on. These are just very common patterns. You find these in every culture that we know of. There's never been a culture that's been recorded that didn't have some sort of notion of the divine, and furthermore, you find that the divine is always used to explain the origins of that particular culture, as well as the origins of everything else. And Plato talks about this in the Republic. He talks about what are the uses of stories that we know can't be true in a literal sense, by which you mean myths. And he says, well, you know, if we're trying to deceive our enemies, those are useful. If we're trying to deceive our friends in order to make them better, that's a useful thing. The most important use of stories that are false is to talk about the gods and to talk about the origins of things, because we can't have any knowledge of what's true. And if you can't have any adequate knowledge of the gods and the origins of things, then you have to come up with a likely story. And myths are likely stories. And so we've stepped out of history and into myth. And you find that with every culture, there's this point, sometimes imperceptible, where historical truth shades off into myth. And so what we need to do now is we need to talk a little bit about myth. And I just want to characterize myth in a number of ways. What myths are pre-philosophical and pre-scientific accounts of the origins and the nature of the order. What particular order there is and where it comes from are accounted for in myths. And this would include accounts of cosmic order. It would be an account of human order, man's nature and man's condition. It would be an account of particular traditions and customs and institutions. And most importantly, it's going to be an account of the origin of right and wrong, the origin of the moral law. Now, there are several characteristics of myth that I want to talk about briefly. First of all, myths are always in the form of stories, narratives. One thing happens after another. And there's stories about characters, and the characters are usually personifications of some force of nature, or they're gods, or demigods. Another very important characteristic of myth is that they don't have any known authors. They always seem to come from the beginning of time, before people have any recollection of the names of authors. And there's a quality about them where they just sort of come out of nowhere. The Hindu Upanishads, they sort of lie at the boundary of philosophy and myth. But they too have no known author. And the word Upanishad just means what is heard. There's just a sense that someone heard these things. They're revealed in some sense. People were hearing voices or whatever. You don't have to, you know, interpret it too literal-mindedly. But the fact of the matter is that there's no sense of a myth being a creation of a human being. They're not human inventions. And in fact, it might be closer to the truth, although it sounds very peculiar, to say that human beings are more accurately creations of myths. Because who we are, on a very fundamental level, owes much to the stories we tell about ourselves and have been telling about ourselves ever since we can remember. Now I want to go into a sort of naturalistic account of where myths come from. Then I want to talk about the ancient poets of Greece. And then we can start talking about the beginning of philosophy. Ernst Cassirer and Jean-Baptiste Vico have given accounts of the origin of myth that are very similar. And I just want to sort of give you a pastiche of the two thinkers' views. And the basic account of both of them is this. The passion, if you will, or the affect at the root of a myth is fear. Imagine primitive human beings wandering around, living in caves, gathering berries in forests, surrounded by saber-toothed tigers and other horrible creatures, being rained upon and stormed upon, snowed upon. Nature is a very frightening thing. They don't understand why nature does the things it does, and they don't understand how to control it and how to cope with it. And so nature is frightening. And early man lived in a constant state of fear and trembling. Now, fear and trembling is not a pleasant thing, and therefore human beings spontaneously try to figure out how to overcome their fear, and the way to do that is to understand the world and come to master it in some way. Now, we naturally understand new and unfamiliar things on the model of things that are more familiar to us, old and familiar things. And even though primitive men probably didn't have much understanding of themselves, they still understood themselves better than, say, the thunder. And so the natural tendency was to try and understand the forces of nature on the analogy to the human mind. And so, mythical thought has a tendency to personify natural forces, to anthropomorphize natural forces, to project human characteristics out onto the natural world. And Kasila thinks that the beginning of naming, the beginning of language and concepts, all is derived from personal names, proper names. The first names that human beings gave to things were not general names like thunder, but personal names like Jove. And Kasila actually thinks that languages where nouns have gender might actually be recording traces of the genders of the proper names given to things in the very earliest of times. Primitive peoples, and even people today for them, tend to think that just naming something gives you a power over it. So, for instance, we have this attitude in a somewhat superstitious way with science. If we can take an ordinary concept in ordinary language and translate it into a scientific name, give a scientific name to it, then we feel that we somehow mastered it, or at least there's an obligation now to master it. So, for instance, there's a folk concept we call stupidity. And stupidity is something we just can't really do anything about. It's just a fact of nature. But if you can redefine stupidity in scientific language as a pathology, then the presumption is we can master it, or we have to now master it, and we have to cater to those who are stupid. Right, not just find them jobs in the service industry, but everything has to be turned around, and we have to cater to it. We have to solve it. It becomes a problem that society has to get together and solve. And so I'm very, very suspicious whenever category of folk language, if you will, ordinary language, is replaced by the scientific term, because what it usually does is it first shears off any moral connotations, and it also turns around and gives you an expectation that now we have an obligation to change this fact. You can engineer it or cure it or whatever out of existence. And so children who are a little slow, maybe not particularly gifted in ordinary terms, now become children who have pathologies that have to be cured. Yeah, a lot of that. I mean, a lot of that I just suspect might be just a new way of talking about kids who are a little slow. A lot of it has to do with the fact that the stuff they're being taught is so boring that they couldn't pay attention to it unless they were drugged into zombieism with Ritalin, you know. But, I mean, that might be the other side of it. I'm sure it's a little bit of both. Hyperactive children are generally, I think, hyperactive because the stuff they're being taught is not going to keep their attention, oftentimes. I remember I was considered a hyperactive child. I was just, in folk terms, I was just bored and restless. But as soon as it's called hyperactivity, then there's a drug that you can give, and the world has to cater to it. It becomes a disability, and the Americans with Disabilities Act kicks in, right? The point is that there is this kind of transformation that goes on. When you give a new name to something, even today, there's a sense that, okay, now we can start changing it, we can transform it, we can master it, engineer it away. It gives us power over things to have a new name for it. And oftentimes, we have all kinds of strange and seemingly puzzling arguments over mere terminology. Why do people want to control the terminology that people use? Well, there's because naming brings power. And with very primitive people, you find that, for instance, a person will not give their real name. You're given a name, but then you're given another name as a cover. Why? Well, because if somebody knew that your real name, they would have power over you. There are many traditional people who will give a child a name and then try and forget it as quickly as possible, or hide it by giving them another name, because the assumption is that if somebody knows your real name, they have some kind of power over you. And so it's quite understandable to think that primitive peoples might simply have regarded it as an increase in power simply to give a personal name to a phenomenon of nature. Because once you personify a force of nature, you're projecting the idea that there's a mind behind it, and you can try and come up, enter into a personal relationship with it. You can try and understand its motivations. You can try and understand what makes it tick. And then, just as we, once we understand the motivations of our friends and neighbors, we can make it worth their while to change their behavior patterns, right? We can find that the gods want sheep, lots of them, slaughtered and burned, and they, if we give them enough sheep or human sacrifices or whatever, they'll stop the drought. We can find out what they want and make it worth their while to do as our do our bidding, and that gives us the foundation of magic and religious rituals. Also, another step that's very important in the creation of myth is this. In order to give more and more comprehensive accounts of how all the forces of nature relate to one another, to get a more and more holistic and adequate view of the world, you have to find a way of relating all these personified forces of nature, these spirits and gods, together. And so the way that you would relate human characters together is you try and tell stories about their interactions. And so the narrative structure of myth comes about as a way of knitting together or synthesizing all these different forces of nature in an intelligible way. And the most comprehensive myth would be an account of the whole of nature. And you can find highly developed mythological accounts of virtually everything in a society that's existed for a sufficient amount of time and has refined their understanding of the world. This is very much part of the background of philosophy in Greece. The Greeks had a myth for everything, to explain anything. And it's the replacement of myth with another kind of explanation, namely a scientific explanation, that is one of the most monumental and revolutionary changes that marks the beginning of philosophy in Greece. Now, a third thing that we need to deal with are the Greek poets, because they provide a very important background for Greek philosophy. There's a fellow named Paul Vane, a French scholar, who's written a book called Did the Greeks Believe Their Myths? And it's a very good question, because their attitude towards their myths is very, very different from, say, Jewish or Christian or Islamic attitudes towards the founding stories of those religions. Because it would not be permitted for, say, a great Muslim novelist to come out with a new Quran with a different ending. Spice it up with a car chase or something like that. It wouldn't happen. But for the ancient Greeks, the poets would rewrite their myths. So you would find Homer and Hesiod, who are the two most important poets of ancient Greece, who would take up elements of the mythical worldview and they would transform it. They'd add to it. They'd embroider it. Yeah. And the great tragedians of Athens in the 5th century and 4th centuries would rewrite the myths and transform them. They would bring out new dimensions to them. And you would actually find that this would be done by politicians and orators, for instance. One of the ways that two Greek cities might negotiate a conflict would involve not just calculating how many troops they could field against one another and whether or not their allies would come to their aids, and whether or not they might ought to make peace, but they'd also try and come up with mythical explanations or accounts of things that would justify war or peace or the subordination of one city to another. Your city was founded by a descendant of Heracles, whereas we were founded by a descendant of Zeus. And Zeus ranks over Heracles, so we should rule your city. Okay, I mean, they would do things like this. And it was an amazingly plastic kind of language that myth provided in order to account for things and to make sense out of them. Myths would be transformed in the light of new circumstances to come to an understanding of them. They'd be transformed to ratify new social conditions or to justify something that had to be done. One of the great secrets of statesmanship today, and as in any other time, is to come up with a way of disguising radical changes as mere resurrections of ancient and lost institutions. Well, the process of legislation, political statesmanship, and so forth, it often involves a capacity to disguise something radically new as a restoration of something old and venerable. The language of revolution doesn't sit well with most people. The poets were remarkable moral educators in Greece. The myths of the gods were not particularly morally edifying. For instance, you wouldn't want to model your family after Zeus's family. It just wouldn't work. Zeus was a very bad guy. I mean, he's castrated his father and threw him into a pit. Well, his father ate his children. It goes on and on. The Greek gods were very bad. Zeus married his sister, Hera, and then cheated on her constantly. Yeah.
It was like Lot in the cave. That was what the man did.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he could have, you know, pooped
it.
I mean, he could have gotten some Egyptian god, I suppose, an Egyptian mail order bride. But the thing is, there are plenty of Egyptian goddesses. But the thing is that it was a very peculiar family, and no one would ever want their children to imitate the Greek gods. And so if you were going to look for moral exemplars to teach the young, you would go to Homer, for instance. Because the Greek religion was not very good about teaching moral lessons. And so the poets not only transformed the mythology, but they were also a significant source of moral education. Now, this background is important to have in place simply because it makes it easier to appreciate what a revolutionary change came about when philosophy began. And so, why don't we look at the beginning of this pre-Socratic reader, Thales, who by convention is the first Greek philosopher, was born in Miletus, which is now in Turkey. Thales was a remarkably odd fellow. He was born to a good family, yet he lived in poverty. He didn't get involved in politics, which all respectable upper-class Greeks did. Instead, what he did is he spent a lot of time outside the city walls, not engaged in farming or war or any useful things like that, but just wandering around looking at nature. And one of the earliest stories of him is that, this is on page 9, once while Thales was gazing upwards while doing astronomy, he fell into a well. A clever and delightful Thracian serving girl is said to have made fun of him, since he was eager to know the things in the heavens, but failed to notice what was in front of him and right next to his feet. So Thales was both a very impractical person, as far as worldly affairs are concerned, and very much interested in theoretical matters, interested in gazing. Gazing upwards, the Greek verb is theorein, from which we get the word theory. He was gazing upwards. And he was looking at the courses of the stars. Now, he wasn't looking at the stars as gods, necessarily, as other ancient peoples did. He regarded them as natural phenomena. He was observing them very carefully, trying to come up with the capacity to predict natural phenomena and control natural phenomena. And the next testimony is this. The story goes that when they found fault with him for his poverty, supposing that philosophy is useless, he learned from his astronomy that there would be a large crop of olives. Then, while it was still winter, he obtained a little money and made deposits on all the olive presses, both in Miletus and Chios. Since no one bid against him, he rented them cheaply. When the right time came, suddenly many tried to get the presses all at once, and he rented them out on whatever terms he wished, and so made a great deal of money. In this way, he proved that philosophers can easily be wealthy if they desire, but this is not what they are interested in. He was known for his poverty, but he had to demonstrate in some sense that he was poor not because of any defect, but simply because of a fundamental choice. And the choice was of a different kind of life, obviously, than the life led by respectable gentlemen. It was a theoretical life, or contemplative life, but his primary concerns were understanding natural phenomena. He was an astronomer. Thales is in some ways better understood as the first scientist than the first philosopher, because there's nothing particularly philosophical about what he's doing in the reports that have come down to us. Thales' most famous claim is that everything is water, which is an extraordinary claim. The water in the sink is water, and appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, the sink too is water, and we're all water as well, seems to be the claim. Now, that sounds fanciful, but it's not a mythical claim, because what it really is an attempt to give an account of everything, the origins of everything, all the processes you observe in nature, based not on any kind of mythological account, but simply based on a natural principle, which you call water. And basically the idea is this: everything is water in some form or another. And so you can give a complete account of everything in terms of basically two things. First of all, you have to have an underlying substance, namely water, the stuff that everything is made out of. And then what you need is a principle that accounts for the transformation of water into all the different forms that it takes. Now, that's a very radical project, and it has nothing whatsoever in common with the mythological account of the cosmos, which is notoriously complex. You look at Egyptian mythology, for instance, or Hinduism, for that matter. Until the 19th century, when Indians were going off to Oxford and getting educated, the very idea that there's a single Hindu religion, well, didn't really exist. And there was an attempt to impose some kind of order to the Hindu pantheon. It was discovered it was simply impossible. It was possible for the Hindus today, as well as then, or the ancient Egyptians, to hold innumerable, contradictory, mutually exclusive beliefs on any particular subject matter, and to populate the cosmos with endless, you know, scads of gods. I knew this woman from India once who said, "I like having millions of gods." I said, "Well, I guess it's convenient, you know, you can always explain anything if you've got literally millions of gods to do it with." What Thales did is he just swept away that complex mythological account of the cosmos and came up with one material principle, namely water, and some mysterious process of condensation and rarefaction by which water takes on the forms of everything that we see around us. Now, that's pretty silly in some ways, I suppose, but it represents an enormous transformation in the history of thought. He's really the first natural scientist. It's the first attempt to give a naturalistic, non-mythological account of the whole cosmos. And that's a remarkable achievement. Thales was followed by Anaximander, who was a student of his, also a Milesian. And Anaximander basically accounted for everything, not in terms of water, but in terms of what he called the apeiron, which just means the indefinite or the infinite. The reason why he chose to say the indefinite rather than water is basically this. To say that everything is water doesn't explain particular watery characteristics that exist, right? You just treat those as given. And so it's not really a complete explanation of everything, because you're just assuming that there's water with its peculiar characteristics and not explaining it. What Anaximander did is he basically argued that we can go deeper. We can come up with a principle that will explain even more comprehensively than Thales's. And so he said that everything definite arises out of what isn't definite, or the indefinite, the infinite. And again, he comes up with a kind of process by which the indefinite takes on all of its definite forms and flavors and becomes the world we see around us. The first fragment of actual text in the history of philosophy is from Anaximander. And it's on page 12, and I'm a little irritated with the editor of the text because he doesn't set the fragment off clearly. Instead, he just gives this passage, this number 6, from Simplicius's commentary on Aristotle's Physics, which has the quote embedded in it. But the quote itself consists of the last four lines. He says, "The things that are perish into the things out of which they come to be according to necessity, for they pay penalty and retribution to each other for their injustice in accordance with the ordering of time." That's the first fragment in the history of Western philosophy that's come down to it. 12, where it says 6, fragment number 6, the last four lines, "The things that are perish into the things out of which they come to be according to necessity, but they pay penalty and retribution to each other for their injustice in accordance with the ordering of time." The ordering of time refers to processes of nature, change and transformation. And injustice and injustice refers to a kind of law, if you will, a natural law that orders all the transformations of things in time. Basically, the cosmos consists of this indefinite stuff, both giving rise to definite things, and then the definite things breaking up and going back into the indefinite and being constantly recycled in accordance with some process, some cosmic process that he refers to as necessity. And it's governed by a kind of justice. Now, necessity is a very important concept here. In mythical thought, there's a notion of fate. But what necessity refers to here is a kind of force that moves the cosmos that doesn't make any reference to intentions or ideas. Again, it's a non-anthropomorphic, non-personified understanding of what moves things around. If you ask a person who has a mythical understanding of things, who moves the clouds, they'll say, well, Zeus moves the clouds. Whereas for Anaximander, it's necessity that moves the clouds. And what's important about that distinction is that necessity doesn't presuppose any mind. It's just a dumb force of nature. There's no planning, no intention, no thought behind it. It's just a blind force of nature, which is, again, an extraordinary transformation. Nature is being depersonified. It's being de-anthropomorphized. And things in nature are being understood not on a model of mind, but simply as mindless things that are actuated and moved around by mindless forces, the force of necessity. There's another interesting set of fragments on page 13, numbered 13, 14, and 15. Anaximander tried to give an account of the origins of life that didn't make any reference to gods. Anaximander says that the first animals were produced in moisture, enclosed in thorny barks. When their age increased, they came out onto the drier part, their bark broke off, and they lived a different mode of life for a short time. 14. He also declares that in the beginning, humans were born from other kinds of animals, since other animals quickly manage on their own, and humans alone require lengthy nursing. For this reason, in the beginning, they would not have been preserved if they had been like this. And then 15. Anaximander believed that there arose from heated water and earth either fish or animals very like fish. And these humans grew and were kept inside as embryos up to puberty. Then finally they burst, and men and women came forth, already able to nourish themselves. Now this is a very peculiar account of things. It's a purely naturalistic account of the origin of life. And it's the first, if you will, evolutionary account, because of its arguments that human beings evolved in some way out of non-human and subhuman kinds of animals. And again, they're forces of necessity at work here. They're not forces of design or intelligence that are causing this. Now, Anaximenes is somebody I particularly suggested that you read. And Anaximenes is very important for understanding the clouds, as is Diogenes of Apollonia, who came many years later, for this reason, that the whole idea of the clouds seems to make reference to the doctrines taught by these people. Because Anaximenes and also Diogenes of Apollonia both taught that the ultimate stuff out of which the cosmos arises is not water, like Thales, or the infinite, like Anaximander, but instead, it's air. We sort of have an Athenocentric way of reading the ancient history, because Socrates is just Socrates, and Plato is just Plato. But if somebody came from outside of Athens, it's always Diogenes of Apollonia, or Thales of Miletus, or whatever. So the presumption is that if there's no name, they're an Athenian. If there's no city name, they're an Athenian. If they're a non-Athenian, you have to have some indication of where they come from. And that's simply in view of the fact that Athens was the center of the cultural life of Greece during the 5th century BC. A great deal of culture and it happened outside of Athens and its orbit. Earlier than that, philosophy emerged in the Greek city-states in Turkey, and also in the Greek city-states in southern Italy and Sicily. All of these people seemed to start moving towards Athens, or their teachings started moving towards Athens. So there's this Athenocentrism, if you will. But both of them taught that everything arises out of air. Now, some people think, well, this seems like backsliding, right? Because you could see, you could give this, the objection to Anaximenes and this notion of air that you could give to Thales, which is, well, you know, that explains everything except air. What explains air? Isn't there some underlying force from which airy qualities arise? Well, I think Anaximenes might have thought, well, it's better to have a principle that underlies things, that has some qualities, otherwise, how do you even know it's there? The trouble with the indefinite or the infinite is that it's precisely that which has no qualities of its own. So it's indistinguishable from nothing. This notion that Anaximenes had that being has no qualities makes being indistinguishable from nothing, because isn't nothing the absence of any qualities?
No, there.
Yeah. That's Gertrude Stein about Oakland. Okay. Oakland, yes. You could say that about many other locations, but I think she said it particularly about Oakland. So Anaximenes seems to want to have some kind of characteristics for his ultimate stuff, and the air is it. And so, again, he comes up with this notion that there's one substance out of which all things arise, and there's a process by which the substance undergoes transformation, and so we have all the different things that don't appear to be fairly airy, like this tabletop, for instance, and ourselves. We don't seem to be particularly airy. And then there's air, like the air around us, and then there's smoke and clouds. And it's an interesting idea, because air is a very fluid thing, right? And you can see air getting dense, like with smoke or clouds and vapors and things like that. And if you look up into the clouds and watch for long enough, you can see the clouds taking on the shapes of things. And so it's not really silly to think that maybe everything is like a cloud formation, that the world of things around us are just sort of, you know, evanescent cloud formations, where this stuff, this airy stuff, is gathered up and takes on a certain form for a particular period of time and then dissipates according to some cosmic process. It's not entirely silly. Air is also a very good concept for understanding the principle of life, right? When we're alive, we breathe. Air is going in and air is going out, and it's a kind of warm air. And this is a particular point with Anaximenes, that the air he's talking about is a kind of dense, warm mist. So it'd be almost like breath, which has a warmth to it. And when we die, we no longer breathe, and we get cold. And it sort of makes sense to think that if there's any one principle that underlies life and the transformations of all the things in the cosmos, it would be something like warm, vital breath. And this is what he's talking about. According to Anaximenes, on page 15, fragments 19 and 20, it says, Anaximenes determined that air is a god, and that it comes to be and is without measure, infinite and always in motion. And number 20, Anaximenes stated that clouds occur when the air is further thickened. When it is condensed still more, rain is squeezed out. Hail occurs when the falling water freezes, and snow when some wind is caught up in the moisture. And so he's explaining the weather. And if you get more and more condensed air, you get rocks and stones and animals and so forth. So it's just one big spectrum of rarefaction and condensation. Now, it's very interesting that he says air is a god. And Thales is supposed to have said that there's gods in everything. And what does that mean? Well, the story about Thales is this. Aristotle, in his Parts of Animals, relates it. Thales was supposedly warming himself by the stove, and some friends of his arrived and saw him doing this and hesitated to go in. He said, oh, come on in, there are gods here too. Now, the story doesn't make much sense until you know that warming yourself at the stove was a Greek euphemism for taking a dump, to be as crude as possible. And apparently his friends came up upon Thales as he was relieving himself, and he said, there are gods here too, you know, don't be shy. Everything is full of gods. Now, this is a very peculiar notion, and what exactly does it mean? Well, first of all, it's not really compatible with any conventional sense of piety, right? If there are gods in the outhouse too, then being divine is, well, not that divine. Second, There's no necessity of referring to gods to explain any of the things that happen in the world, because you've got the air or the water or the indefinite and the principle of change. So the gods sort of fall out of the picture entirely. And therefore it was not, we'll put it this way, it was widely thought that these natural philosophers didn't believe in the gods of the city, that they were unbelievers in the conventional deities, because their accounts of nature didn't require the hypothesis of gods. They tried to give accounts of things that that specifically excluded reference to gods and their influences. And they had a rather cavalier notion of what divinity was. And this notion of divinity would encompass the high and the low, and would seem to just refer to the cosmos and the natural principles. And it was very common for the Greeks to name the highest principle in any system the divine. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they regarded it as a god in any conventional sense. The Greek natural philosophers would say, well, air is divine, or water is divine, or the indefinite is divine. But they would always hasten to add that the indefinite has no interest in human affairs, totally uninvolved with human things, and in fact, it doesn't even have a mind. So they use the word divine in a very loose sense. You could almost say it sounds like they're just appeasing public opinion, because although it sounds very pious on the surface to say there are gods everywhere, when you start scratching that surface, you start thinking, well, you know, if there are gods everywhere, then it's not the